Hello, good evening. My name's David Jay. Nice to be back with you. Tim Bowling's here as my co-presenter. Chris Jacobs here as our studio assistant, and Chris is going to join us on air in the final half hour of the show. And as for the show, welcome to the second On the Front Foot of this new year of 2018. This is Susie Radio's Cricket Chat Show. Now, quite a bit has happened in the 6 weeks since we were with you last in international cricket, but we're concentrating tonight on local elements because we've got two excellent local guests for you before we join Chris at round about 8:30. Tim, quite a bit's happened since we were here last.
Yes, just a little bit. Lots to talk about, that's for sure.
Well, certainly in that last half hour, there's going to be a great deal to talk about, but I think, as I said at the top, I think it's the local elements and our guests, although our first guest is not entirely local, should I say. Darren Talbot, good evening and welcome to Susie 103.4.
Good evening.
It's absolutely brilliant to have you here. And when I was tweeting you up earlier in the day when I was doing my music show, I did mention that you were going to be a man wearing several hats this evening. And I wonder if we could start off with your club affiliation and your involvement with junior cricket up the road at Weybridge.
Yeah, we've been working there for the past 4 or 5 years. My company were brought in initially just to supply some coaches. It's one of the sort of sad things almost of club cricket these days, that trying to find volunteers is getting harder and harder, and I guess it plays into our hands a little bit, and we can go in and help some clubs. After the first year, the club was still losing members and things weren't quite right, so I came in as sort of head of cricket, and over the last 4 years we've built it back up again from 180 juniors up to 500 now, including 100 girls.
And how difficult is that logistically to organise at one club?
It takes up a fair bit of my time. I think probably now I'm spending 75% of my time all year on Weybridge matters. The summer's obviously very busy because we're organising training most nights of the week. We've got 25 junior teams running this year, so my Sundays are spent going from ground to ground watching games. But even sort of planning ahead for the season, deciding which training nights we're going to have, how many coaches we need, where we're going to do it, how we're going to stop the outfit from getting ruined, it's never ending. And organising fixtures, we've got 250 junior fixtures this year.
So in terms of viewing players, you'd regard yourself as perhaps a little more hands-on than Trevor Bayliss with the England setup?
I think I could argue that fairly positively, and certainly away from home, I think I can pick a better team.
Now, I'd like to ask you about the company, because I think that's where you have your connection with our colleague Chris, who's currently lounging in the background but is going to be on air with us later. But before I do that, in terms of Weybridge, who are obviously considerable rivals for our local premiership club, Reigate Priory, have you had a lot to do with my good friend Phil Mann?
Yes, I know Phil very well. Phil's obviously captain of the club, and this year he's taking on running a senior junior academy, if you like. So for the older players who we're kind of looking to fast track into the first and second team, he's taken on an additional role there. So as well as being club captain, he's also head coach this year, which is fantastic.
And of course he's off to Wellington College come September, so he'll be back on the Berkshire side of Weybridge rather than languishing over here in East Surrey. What about the Curran brothers? Do you have anything to do with them?
Not so much. They came down. There was a benefit day for Gareth Batty we had this summer, which was a brilliant day. They were both down there then, and one of them, I can't remember which one it was now, hit six sixes and over in the game, which really made the day, but it was a fantastic occasion.
How do you think Weybridge are going to go on in the Premiership this year?
Well, we've signed a very good overseas player from New Zealand, I understand, and we've got one of the Surrey peripheral players who I think is going to start making more of a breakthrough playing for us this season. So I think we've got every chance of pushing the best clubs.
Sounds good to me. Now, tell us a bit about the company and how you came to know Chris Jacobs.
Right, well, the company's been going almost 11 years to the day, actually, and Chris joined us 2 years ago, I think, as one of our coaches, and more recently, he now stars in our touring team when we go off to Vienna each year for an indoor tournament.
Yes, we'll be asking Chris about that. Just give us a little heads up about the Vienna thing, Darren. We'll save the nitty-gritty for Chris.
It's a fun tournament, good quality cricket, big social.
Excellent. And in terms of facilities at Weybridge, is it just the one ground?
Just the one ground. We're very lucky this year. We've after a bit of negotiation, we've managed to get St George's College for Sundays. So we've got three pitches there all day, which means we've got nine games we can play. Without that, we'd be struggling, because last year we played all our games at the ground and it was looking a bit tired towards the end.
Always enjoyed St George's as a ground and as a standard of cricket. I remember taking a decent under 17 side there in the cup and running into both Hollyoaks, and it wasn't so much the batting, it was the fact that they were good enough to bowl their whatever it was, eight overs for a dozen runs.
Yeah, young Adam, I played against him when I was at school, and he was pretty quick in those days. He was the quickest around in junior cricket, and we never really saw that because he got a back injury before he hit the Surrey team. But in those days, nobody wanted to open against him.
So that's Weybridge. Tim, we've got Matt Camp coming in
yes,
second. Just tell us a bit about Matt.
Matt is running a tournament called Surrey Slam, who I think... do you know Matt at all?
I do, yes.
Yeah. Surrey Slam is a midweek T20 tournament with the idea of trying to introduce people into cricket. I mean, Matt will tell us more about it when he comes in, but I think it's just trying to bring in more people to playing sort of more of a social short form of cricket, just try and get people into the game, I think.
So, Darren, your short CV in front of me mentions running T20 community cricket full-time. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I worked in the city for 13 years and had the misfortune of being signed off for 3 months with, frankly, just having had enough of it. I've been coaching for a while. I set up a juniors at Cobham Avorians back in 2004. And having played a fair bit of good standard cricket, found I enjoyed my coaching. And then when the work situation came along, I decided I need to take a summer out, do a bit of coaching, did a bit of stuff for Surrey. And I had never appreciated quite how poor the state school cricket was. And I had that sort of eureka moment and thought, this is what I want to do the rest of my life. And that was 11 years ago. And really what we've just set out to do broadly is to create cricketing opportunities for those who aren't getting as much as they possibly could do, and it's gone quite broad from state school cricket in the UK to all sorts of interesting things in Europe, but that's really what we set out to do, and we're not for profit, and really is just trying to help people in the cricket world.
And does that extend across a number of local clubs as far as you're concerned yourself?
Yeah, probably with our commitments to Weybridge getting bigger and bigger, we end up probably working with fewer clubs than we used to. But I'm also in my spare time chairman of the West Surrey Youth Cricket League, which is the biggest junior league in the county. So there are 63 clubs involved in that, and I have a fair bit to do with all of those. So I've got a fairly broad portfolio there.
I remember that famous remark of Tolkien's about butter being spread too thinly on the bread. You clearly maximise your time, Darren, in every possible way.
I love what I do. I'm very, very fortunate that I can do something that is my passion, and spare time is there to be found to be doing something else in cricket. Not quite what my wife tells me, but yeah.
I hardly dared inquire whether there was a lady wife at home. You must have a very understanding lady wife indeed. So we've looked loosely at the T20 side and your particular involvement with junior cricket at Weybridge. You mentioned briefly your playing career. Tell us a bit about that.
I played under 19 cricket for Surrey, and there was a Surrey Young Cricketers in those days. It doesn't really exist anymore. So I played in that from 16. I had loads and loads of trials, and I thought did pretty well, never got in. And then I was playing for my school team against another school and took 7 wickets. And it just so happened that the other school's coach was one of the Surrey managers. And he had a quiet word with me at tea time and said, well, do you fancy playing for the county? It was a very old question, because it's not really one you say no to. And so I was fortunate. I played 3 or 4 years in the Surrey setup. Didn't really do myself justice, I think, if I'm honest.
From long personal experience, and I, in spite of my long experience running school cricket, I always describe myself as a manager first and a coach nowhere, because I think you need very specific talents to be a coach. But from that long experience and other people that I was involved with in my cricketing team of adults, it seems to me that very often it isn't necessarily the people who've got the test caps and starred in the county first team who make the best coaches.
No, I think that's something that we hear quite a lot. Obviously, I'm sort of biased from that point of view a little bit. But I think you find that the people who have got the sort of first-class experience, test experience, don't go on the playground very often. And I think playgrounds is where you learn to coach. That's where you learn to understand how to control a group, how to get the best out of a group. And it's all very well coaching polished prep school kids. That's brilliant. But actually, you know, you need to work with a variety of people, I think, to have rounded skills.
Well, I must confess to having spent 36 years in the independent sector myself, but not at prep school level. 25 of those were coaching the first 11 at the grammar school in Reigate, although, as I say, I always use the term managing. I think it's very interesting, too, from the umpiring point of view, Darren, and after I stopped my management role, I did an awful lot of first-team games in the days when there was still a bit of declaration cricket and increasing amount of 50-over cricket. And I think you do also need that sensitivity to the mindset and the approach and the attitude of 16, 17, 18-year-olds as an umpire. I've found a number of very highly qualified umpires who didn't necessarily want to give boys whom we were trying to encourage and who were learning the game the benefit of any doubt.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. We're preparing some tournaments in the summer, and I'm looking out for umpires for that. And umpiring junior cricket, I think, is a skill that it almost better suits coaches to do the umpiring, because umpiring will, I think, it naturally lends itself to people who like rules, laws, structure, organisation, and of course there are times when you need to. If you're running a junior game, you need some common sense as well, and it's a bit like running a league. You have your rules there, and actually, if you deviate from them in the slightest, then it's actually very hard to progress. So, I can understand the position. I think personally, it's better suited to people who work with the kids on a regular basis than this.
We were talking the other night about the difficulty with these now even more hard and fast laws in the new law book, and the situation where an umpire who's got all his qualifications and knows the law backwards is confronted with the under 13C bowler who can hardly keep it on the cut strip and then lets one go quite accidentally at somebody's head.
Yeah, the new laws don't seem to leave an awful lot of scope for encouraging those kids, because actually they're the ones that can't actually bowl it properly. The ones we want to keep bowling. The last thing we want to be doing is you've bowled two of those and you're off. And certainly now in our junior league rules, we're exempting that.
I'm going to chuck you an Adam Holyoake knuckleball now and ask Tim to quiz you on the twin concepts of sanctions and levels of sanctions under the new law 42, and also this business of penalty time. And I'm going to shut up for a bit.
Well, thanks for that curveball. David and I actually attended an umpires association. Presentation the other night where we were presented with the new laws, and one of those was the penalty time set of laws and the new sanctions. What are your thoughts on the sort of new laws that have been brought in?
I think there's an awful lot of common sense there. They're the run-outs with once you're grounded and they're getting rid of the sort of bouncing back questions. Things like that are perfect common sense. I do worry that we do need to do something about behaviour in cricket. One of the reasons I stopped playing when I did were the number of times that I was getting quite verbally abused by 17-year-olds. And I was thinking that the game's gone wrong here somewhere, and actually it's been quite nice being in coaching because you can actually do something about that and stop that from happening. But local club cricket, there are very few qualified umpires, and once you get blow about Division 2, you'll be lucky to see an umpire. These guys have got no chance of being able to enforce any laws like this. So it's all very well bringing it in at the top level, but trying to enforce that, even at the sort of Premier Division and in Division 1, it's a very tough call for umpires who umpire for 20 games, 30 games a season to be able to enforce that. So
yeah, I think you're right in saying that the problem's going to be when you have, for example, players umpiring in third 11 matches, for example, and there's, let's call it argy-bargy. So will a player who's umpiring be able to actually point to the sanctions and use them with any sort of authority? Who knows? I think it's going to be a difficult one. You're quite right that there does need to be an element of common sense shown, as you've said, in the junior level. It's going to be a little bit harder, I think, with the senior cricket to perhaps deviate from any of those laws without remaining consistent. But, you know, I think it's one of those things that I guess we're going to have to sort of suck it and see a bit.
Yeah, it'll be an interesting season. There is a very strong reporting process, certainly in the Surrey Championship, and when players do step out of line, reports go in, players get banned. I think that works pretty well, and I think probably these new laws are going to be overkill for our cricket, but we'll see what happens.
I'm all for sanctions at the top level, and so long as you've got qualified umpires, sanctions as low as the level may be, because you're absolutely right, Darren, towards the end of my playing time, which is longer now than I care to remember, but towards the end of my playing time, I was just fed up with it. It was no fun anymore. The attempts at physical intimidation by bowlers, which didn't really cut much ice with somebody who'd spend his life with a bat in his hand, but the verbals and the way, to me, as a master in charge at school before I finished, and certainly as an umpire in school first team cricket, the way in which the mouth took over, and I mean the mouth from third man and fine leg, I don't mean short leg whispering under the batsman's helmet or whatever, and really and truly that was one reason why in the end I hung the white coat up as well.
Yeah, I really don't blame you for that. It's a shame. I guess it reflects society a little bit. I think society has changed over the last 15, 20 years, and some of the language used is unfortunately a little bit more acceptable in everyday society, and so it spills on the cricket pitch as well. And I just wanted to play cricket at that stage just to enjoy myself, having had my opportunity to make it or not make it. If you're not enjoying a game of cricket, I was waking up in the morning praying for rain, and that was the point where I thought, this is crazy.
John Arlott, bless him, I'm sure you're absolutely right. John Arlott always said that cricket unfailingly reflects the background of society against which it's played, and I think that's as true now as it was back then. Now, I've got a fair amount of ICC experience, Darren. Most of mine is with Jersey, where I've got good friends, and I watch quite a bit of Jersey cricket, as they seem to vacillate between Division 4 and Division 5, and a bit like the football, no sooner are they up than they're down again, and so it goes. But they go to some amazingly interesting places, and I'm sure Tim is absolutely bursting to ask you about cricket in Iceland.
Yes, I was fascinated when we first got in touch with each other to see that you were the Iceland national head coach. I'm just curious how that came about, how that works, and how well you're doing.
Well, it really came about because we've been coaching in Europe quite a lot right from the start. I was a bit of a linguist at school, so lots of holidays in Europe, and quite fancied trying to combine my two passions of travelling in Europe and cricket. And sort of 7 or 8 years ago, we went over to Bonn, did a bit of coaching in Germany, and that evolved with a lot of coaching in Switzerland. In fact, the last 2 weekends of this month, I'm off to Geneva to coach the Swiss under-11, under-13 national teams. And there's a lot of cricket going on in Europe, much more than you realise. Germany had a fantastic time. They're 125, 130 clubs now, thanks to the refugees. Mrs. Merkel has done cricket in Germany absolute wonders, and vice versa, because they're integrating these youngsters into the society, teaching the language, and getting to know people. So I was already fairly well known in the sort of cricket oddities circle for doing coaching abroad, and then I got a Facebook or Twitter message from one of the guys out in Iceland, and talking about what they were doing. I thought, well, I haven't been to Iceland before, and semi-invited myself over to do a bit of coaching. Absolutely loved it, and it kind of evolved from there.
So, presumably the team is playing in the World Cricket League. Is it the Icelandic team?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't work quite like that, unfortunately. So ICC Europe has probably, I think, 25 members, I would think, but you have to reach certain criteria to become an ICC member. One of the sort of big ones is you've got to have 6 clubs. There's lots of other bits and pieces attached to it, but cricket in Iceland is very, very small. Part of the problem is that there's nowhere to play.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the pitches, how that actually works.
Well, Iceland, for those who haven't been there, is a bit like the moon. I mean, it's a very, very strange place to go and visit. They're trying to find a sort of green patch of land to play cricket doesn't happen. But all their football is played on artificial pitches, and that's what they do. It's in the summer, it's a very limited summer, They play matches on an artificial football pitch, move it back to one side, playing sort of width ways, but you play a perfectly good game of cricket on it. But a lot of it happens indoors, so all the training camps I've done over there have been indoors, and they have fantastic indoor facilities, better than we've got over here.
So have Iceland played any international matches against other sort of smaller countries?
It's a very good question. Not yet, but on the 28th of July, they're coming over to the UK and will be playing against Switzerland in a one-day international at St George's College, Weybridge.
Wow.
And the following day, there'll be two T20 games against Switzerland. So that'll be our international breakthrough. Nothing formal insofar as ICC and things, but there's an awful lot of sort of under-the-card cricket that goes on that those countries that who aren't involved in the formal competitions regularly play against each other, and that'll be breaking our duck.
Darren, you must make sure that we've got details of those games, because Weybridge is not a million miles away, and you never know what Susie Radio might be able to do as far as an international debut like that. So there's no question of finding a field of crumbled lava and sticking a mat on the top of it is what I wanted to ask.
No. Not so, a chance.
Sorry, Tim, do carry on.
No, I was going to say that you mentioned in Germany that there was the amount of clubs and players there are now. It's quite interesting when football friends of mine say, oh, well, of course, there's only sort of a dozen countries in the world that play cricket, and I often say to them, well, no, there isn't. There's dozens and dozens and dozens of countries that play, in the same way that in the football world they play in lower leagues, in cricket they play in the lower leagues as well. But there is that presence right across Europe and right round the world now.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, we work with some guys out in Africa as well. We've been sponsoring a club in Sierra Leone for the last 4 or 5 years. And more recently, I've helped the Ivory Coast get their cricket association off the ground. And the passion in these countries is such that once they get one or two people who really grab the bull by the horns, it goes mad. They've got a women's team now. And this has all happened in 2 years.
There's this wonderful new development, isn't there, which has been widely featured, the first grass cricket ground in Rwanda, that a lot of people have been organising internationally and fundraising and so on and so forth. Certainly when Jersey were last hosting Division 4 or 5, whichever it was, Tanzania were there, Oman were there, Vanuatu were there, for heaven's sake, from the South Pacific. So there's every reason for Iceland to aim high, Darren.
Oh, absolutely. We were banding around some statistics of populations and looking at people in Iceland go, well, Iceland, it's too small, there's, you know, it's not in our culture. But Vanuatu and Papua New Guinea and so many other countries have got a fraction of the population that Iceland have.
Are most of the players in the Icelandic setup expats, or are they Icelandic nationals?
We have one Icelandic national who grew up in Australia, but we've got 3 or 4 Icelandic speakers, so they are people who I think could quite reasonably be regarded as sort of part of the Icelandic furniture now. And the good news is, having my last trip over there, we actually came across a refugee who made it into Iceland. I think it's probably more challenging than a lot of places to get to, and now realise that the Icelandic government actually run a refugee programme where there's funding to get these guys doing something meaningful. So all of a sudden we've gone from 25 players to sort of 40-45 players in literally 2 months, which is going to give us a much better chance of progressing things and hopefully getting a good squad for our upcoming tour.
I was going to ask, is the Icelandic Cricket Association, presumably that's an official body, is it?
And it is. It has a board of 4, of which I'm now one, and another member is actually someone who lives in Richmond and runs an Icelandic tour company, so he's also over there quite a lot and a strong vested interest. And after probably 18 months of playing at it a little bit, I think we're at the stage now, we've got a website going, and I can see cricket in Iceland really starting to grow, and ICC membership is something that in 3 to 5 years could actually be feasible.
I think with nationals, it's great oaks from little acorns, isn't it? You've got to start somewhere, and I'm sure that gradually, even though there may be a foundation of expats, there will be more and more national playing members as time goes by.
Yeah, for my next trip over there, which will kind of be October, November, we're actually looking at starting a schools programme as well. Obviously, it's something that I've done over here for the last 10, 11 years. And if we can get over the language barrier, I think one of the Icelandic speakers is planning to try and come with me. So we'll try and pop into some schools and try and sow the seeds of getting some interest over there as well.
Gentlemen, I told you that time would fly, but before we wrap this section of the show up, Darren, do please tell us a bit about your involvement at county and national level with deaf cricket.
Yeah, deaf cricket I've been involved with for 5 years now. I kind of stumbled into it a little bit. One of my coach friends has a profoundly deaf daughter, and he was always talking about the fact that she struggled at school because she had a teacher but also an interpreter. So she was looking at the interpreter but losing an awful lot of visual cues from the teacher as well. And he said, as a level 2 coach and a level 2 signer, he was keen to do something in deaf cricket to try and bring those two together. And me being me, hearing something different and other, you know, creating opportunities, I thought, well, let's have a go at that. And we got involved with the National Deaf Children's Society, ran a couple of courses, and then stumbled across the organisation ECAD, which is the England Cricket Association for the Deaf. And quite rapidly afterwards, I ended up being their development officer and running the Surrey Deaf Team, which we set up, was the first county deaf team. There are now three. Lancashire and Nottinghamshire also have deaf teams. As of yesterday, I was at Lords for a meeting, and I've been asked to be the National Deaf Cricket Pathway Manager for the ECB. So all of a sudden that job is going to be expanding somewhat, and they're bringing back the England Lions Deaf Team for 2019, which I was involved with briefly before the funding went. We've got a T20 World Cup coming up for the England Deaf Team in India towards the end of the year. All of a sudden now there's a very large dangly carrot for deaf people to come and join the pathway, the future of deaf cricket looks absolutely fantastic.
Darren, our warmest congratulations on this latest string of the many to your bow. I'll tell you what fascinates me most about all that is that you came to deaf cricket through a colleague who was interested in his daughter's cricket. And I think that the increase in women's cricket is just the best thing that's happened since the year dot. I really do.
Yeah, I totally agree. And we've barely started with that. I think in the next 3 to 5 years, we're going to see so many more girls playing cricket. The success the England women's team has made quite a big difference, and they're now the county program. Surrey have got a fantastic program going now with lots of competition, lots of encouragement for clubs to get more girls playing. It's helped that rounders has been pushed off the curriculum now. So, in fact, my summer is going to be spent in quite a few schools in the area, teaching the teachers how to deliver cricket, which is quite exciting. So, hopefully, we're going to see even more girls joining clubs.
It's nearly time for us to move on to the second section of the show with another track for the Aussies and a little pair of ad breaks. But before you go, Darren, any very brief reflections on the state of the national and indeed international game for us? Very brief, if you will.
Well, England's performances away from home, I think, are our biggest concern, and it's rather frustrating that we can look $1 million on our own turf, but can't win games away from home. But hopefully, that's one that's going to get solved in the near future. Internationally, obviously, the Australian situation has been very disappointing for the world of cricket. But the Australian Cricket Board have really clamped down on it very hard, possibly too hard, and I think we might possibly see some of those bans getting reduced. But it's been interesting to see how quickly they've stamped down on what is basically cheating. We don't want that in the game.
Darren Talbot, man of many hats and many strings to your bow in the game of cricket. It's been an absolute delight to welcome you for the first time to On the Front Foot here at Susie Radio. Hope you'll come back and see us again.
Yeah, I'd love to do that, yeah.
Thank you very much for being here this evening.
Great. Thank you.
This is indeed Susie Radio 103.4. Hello, good evening. My name's David Jay. Welcome back to the second section of On the Front Foot this Thursday evening. It's my great pleasure now to introduce to you Matt Camp, who's the competition manager of the vastly expanded T20 competition, the Surrey Slam. Matt, good evening and a very warm welcome to Susie 103.4.
Good evening. Thank you for having me.
It's an absolute delight to have you here. Now, tell us your thoughts to start off with. I know that we've got a great deal to talk about with the local angle of a much expanded T20 competition. Tell me, just to kick off with, your thoughts about the position of T20 locally, nationally, internationally, in the overall scheme of all things cricket.
Well, I think this is where we've got a bit of a diverse, really, is that T20 is obviously internationally is taking on such a more prominent position in cricket. I mean, we see the advertisements this week of the start of the IPL, you know, and that's an Indian league, and I do appreciate the international element of it, but how the imagination it's capturing in this country. And but yet, on the domestic side of things, it's, although we, England, kicked it off in 2003 so wonderfully, and we all saw the crowds swelling the grounds, and of course helped by good weather that summer, if I remember rightly, it's kind of sort of nosedived a little bit. I think there was a degree of maybe trying to cash in on the cow a little bit too much, but they've reviewed that, and so we're 2 years away from a sort of rebrand of domestic T20, and we're going to see the franchise competition. And then we go a step further down into the amateur game, and T20's not really been grasped, even though there's obviously the appetite for it from a viewing perspective. And of course, in this day and age where people's lifestyles are so busy, it has a perfect fit in terms of getting people playing cricket, yet we haven't really embraced it so much, I don't feel.
Is it the case, do you think, you talk about people wanting to watch it, is it the case, do you think, that below the very top level, below the county premierships in the various counties, it's very difficult for ordinary players like I was, and Tim, forgive me, is, to produce the level of cricket and the ball flying out of the ground and so on and so forth that spectators would feel entitled to expect given the franchise model on television?
Yeah, that's a very fair point, and of course they're blessed with this sort of equipment that's able to help them on that front as well, and also it's if you've got the eye, it's a lot easier to hit an 80 mile an hour ball with some venom as well. So I do appreciate that it won't quite be the same spectacle on the village green, but I don't think that stops people thinking they can do it.
Of course, on the village green you've got nice short boundaries, I'm thinking outward here locally and Cold Harbour and so on and so forth. The other side of that, I suppose, though, is that it's very hard for village groundsmen to produce surfaces where the ball's going to come on, so that anything that's in the zone can disappear over rather deep, wide, long on.
Yeah, that's a fair point. Having said that, I think there's some groundsmen that do quite a job, and with the way that covers are a little bit more affordable than they used to be. I mean, even if you just have the tarpaulin, not the raised raised covers, that makes quite a difference nowadays. I mean, I know a couple of village sides that I've ever played with or played against. You know, they've managed to make that investment, and it does make a big difference.
Now, you're an Oakwood Hill man yourself. Are you still playing, let me say, proper cricket as distinct from T20 cricket? Are you still doing that at Oakwood Hill?
Well, that's the idea. However, this has taken on a lot of my time, and I haven't pre-season net anywhere or anything like that yet. So, I mean, I'm hoping to try and actually play in this competition.
And tell us just a little bit about Oakwood Hill as a club.
So Oakwood Hill is your classic village club. It's in a very small village, and to be brutally frank, I think nobody from there actually comes from the village. The village is that small. However, it's been there for over 100 years, and the pavilion is an old World War II airfield barracks that was put there once. So it's so classical, but it's full of people that are very committed to the game, very committed to making sure that it's a good quality of game in a nice, friendly atmosphere. And bit by bit, it's been able to grow. So Watford, when I started there, was only one 11, is now two Saturday 11s. And hence, me getting involved in this, has a real appetite for midweek cricket, to the point where Oakwood Hill put two sides out in this competition.
I suppose, Tim, that's almost the reverse of the experience of a number of clubs that we know.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's good that there is that sort of passion there, and that you're able to put out teams like that. So does Oakwood actually play in any sort of league on a Saturday at all? Or is it,
yes,
it does play league cricket.
So they're playing the Surrey Downs League.
Yeah. Okay. And there's two Saturday sides, is it?
Yes.
Yes. I mean, that's pretty good for a village side. I mean, my own club, I can only field two sides now, with a much, much bigger catchment area, so that's pretty impressive.
And you'd have thought of Leatherhead in the old days as a relatively big club.
Yeah, exactly.
Not
exactly
top flight, but relatively big club.
Wasn't that long ago Leatherhead had four Saturday teams out, and they only got two, so it's fair play to you know, that you're still putting out two teams.
So that's the background, and Surrey Downs, is that 40 overs cricket?
It is now, so actually just made the change. It was 3 years ago, it was 90 overs declaration cricket all the way through, and then then it made the decision to split it to 45 overs, half win-lose for half the season, 90 overs for the rest. And then, bit by bit, it's gradually come down to now it's full-on 40-40 win-lose the whole season.
That's interesting. You see, I think the split is the desirable way of doing things. The way the Premiership plays half and half, you play each opposition at both games, and that, to me, mirrors the first-class cricket experience more than any other. But equally, if you want to interest people, and this is where we're coming back to your new initiative now, above everything, you want a win-lose situation, don't you? The draw is out of fashion.
It's seeming that way. I mean, I didn't think, having attended the AGMs of the Surrey Downs League, I didn't think we'd ever get to the point of full-on win-lose. However, it's only taken 2 years for people to be converted.
I think it's a shame, actually, that the declaration cricket is starting to disappear, because some of the best games I think I've ever played in have been games where one team or another has been trying to bat out for a draw and everybody's huddled around the batsman. And I think it's a bit of a shame that the youngsters aren't necessarily going to see those type of games anymore and not have that experience and fun of playing in a declaration game.
That said, there's never going to be declaration T20 cricket, is there? As almost, I mean, it's almost two codes. It's almost rugby league, rugby union, and nothing wrong with that at all, because anything that keeps the game alive. I was just thinking over at the back of my mind there, Matt, you saying it was 2003. It doesn't seem possible. It seems like yesterday that this all kicked off at county level, and clearly the franchise model abroad is the one that's really caught the imagination and the razzmatazz. And as usual, the Australians had the big bash and did it really very, very well, even though they're now slightly fallen from grace, not that we're gloating this evening. You began in a very, very small way, according to the information in front of me, with five teams in 2013.
That's right. It was the midweek competition was part of the Village Cricket League, which kind of operates in the Guildford, Dorking, Horsham triangle, of which Oakwood Hill were a part. And that was, it was kind of falling by the wayside, hence only five teams. And as these things often happen, I was at an AGM and I offered to take on the running of it because no one else was doing it. And then bit by bit, we've got more teams involved. We went outside of the actual league itself, and we just went for a geographical point of view. And so we got up to last year. We got up in that region. We got up to 16 teams, which was fantastic. And it sort of captured the imagination of guys at Surrey as to, because it was bucking the trend of growing rather than shrinking.
And now it's going to be far more than 16 teams.
Yes, we are now up to 64, which is, well, it was beyond my stretch target I had in my mind, yes.
And so how are the logistics of that going to operate, given that Surrey is, what, 40 miles wide? Is it the widest point or whatever? Is this going to be zoned? How's it going to operate?
Yes, well, one of the big things about midweek cricket working is the fact that people can't be travelling here, there and everywhere. So, yes, it will be into four regions of 16, and it's nice and neat. It's northwest, northeast, southwest and southeast. And yeah, so within that 16, over the course of a 13-week period, so starting in the second week of May, you'll end up crowning a regional winner. And you'll do that in all four regions, obviously. And then we'll have a finals day on August Bank Holiday Monday, where the four will come together and play off, and we'll crown a county champion.
It sounds absolutely splendid. Now, where does Oakwood Hill sit divisionally?
So they are in the southwest region.
Southwest, yeah. Okay. Can you tell us a bit about some of the clubs here in, loosely speaking, Redhill, Reigate, Hawley and Crawley have got involved?
Well, this is bang in the southeast region. So it goes as far north as Purley Pumas, and south to Crawley Cheetahs. And the furthest, I'm going to get tested here, aren't I? The furthest west is Brockham Bandits, who actually won the southwest competition last year. And the furthest east are Oxted and Limpsfield Grasshoppers.
So it's fairly widespread. And what about the biggest guns? I mean, are the Reigate Priories getting involved?
Reigate Priory are in it. Yes, there's obviously some concern about how can you pitch a competition whereby you have the big clubs with the village clubs, and so what we've worked very hard on over the last few years, and we think we've got it pretty pretty well working, is there are eligibility rules around players. So this is not designed for the upper echelons of the county. Those guys have got enough cricket to play, and to be brutally honest, they're playing their cricket. This competition is designed to get people back into cricket. We're looking for those people that we've lost for whatever reason, and even those people that never really picked up a ball or a bat as well. So we're pitching this with some very clear rules that the likes of Reigate Priory are fully aware of, and so it's more, at best, it's their second 11 players.
Which is still a reasonable standard, I have to say. We'll have to ask them if and when they come to see us, Tim, on the show.
Yes, one day.
You got any thoughts about all this?
Yeah, I mean, you've got 64 teams in the tournament this year. Is that the maximum that you want to see it, or are you going to try and grow it again next year? I mean, if other clubs are listening and they think, oh, we'd like to get involved with that next year, is there going to be room to get any sort of expansion in the tournament?
Look, whilst 64 is nice and neat, that's a pure fluke. There's no cap on this whatsoever.
Right.
If it ends up with 100 clubs, that's absolutely fine. We'll make it work.
And just in terms of how it works for clubs if they do want to enter, presumably there's a sort of entrance fee, is there, that they pay, and then they get sort of put into the league that they're in and so on?
Yeah, there is, but this is purely a voluntary exercise for me, so it's just covering the costs of the website and stuff. So it's just a fiver, that's it. And it's obviously the match balls. But we've got a deal with a local supplier that ensures that those are competitive as well. So the idea is not to price teams out of this. It's absolute bare minimum cost. And for two match balls you need, and then a fiver, you're talking about £23 for the whole thing.
And it's home and away, is it, for all the teams?
Yeah, so to start with, one thing we didn't want to do is we didn't want to do a knockout competition whereby you can play one game and that's your lot. Mm-hmm. Because competitions in this county have fallen by the wayside because of that. So the idea is that although we've got 16 in the region, they are split into four regionalised groups within. So you have got very little travelling, and as it happens in that group of four to start with, you'll play each other once, but you'll play your most local team twice, right, home and away. But you'll end up with two home games and two away games. And then everyone goes into a knockout stage one way or the other. The top two from each group will go into the knockout stage proper, but then the bottom two, third and fourth from each group, will go into kind of a plate competition. So therefore we're still guaranteeing numbers of games.
I'm going to put you on the spot here now, ever so slightly, and inquire about what happens if there is a tied game or a washout.
Well, the way we work this is that each fixture is allocated a fortnight to play it. So, and the idea is that the home team offers the away team three dates, and two are picked from that. So we have two dates already in the book. So if the first one gets washed out, everyone knows exactly when they're going to try again. Now, of course, if we get washed out twice, we're going to carry on. So if I say it's a 1 point each, simple as that. Same for a tied game.
And what are we doing in terms of coloured cricket balls?
So we use pink balls. We trialled that last year in the South West competition, and it makes incredible difference. I was quite surprised myself, to be honest.
Tell me about the difference you think it made, because I've got some input here, maybe.
Okay, then. Well, the key thing is when we're going past 8 p.m. to be, you know, honest, and it's that dust period. And of course, it varies depending what ground you're playing on. You know, because Oakwood Hill, for example, is trees all the way around it, so might be better to play with a fluorescent yellow ball. But it makes that key difference in that kind of last half hour of the game, I find.
I think that my very limited experience standing in T20 cricket, school's T20 cricket, at Hurstpier Point College, as it happens, was that at 9:30 on a Sunday morning, these things went round corners like boomerangs.
I can well believe that. I mean, actually, look, the because it was a proof of concept last year, and the idea was the competition kind of funded the balls, we used what were pretty much blocks of concrete. They weren't swinging for anybody. Now, look, we've got a much better ball this year, and yes, there's the chance it could do a little bit. But having said that, apart from the first game of the competition for each club, it's then used balls. We're not asking everyone to buy a brand new match ball for each game. So therefore, the chances of anything going around corners after the first game are very limited.
And what about conditions of light? Because we're not blessed with floodlights on village grounds.
No, well, we've got to be sensible about it. And this competition very much throws the management of of the matches into the hands of the clubs. We can't have independent umpires or anything like that. So there does need to be that sense, and if you know it's going to get very overcast that night, then the teams are encouraged to maybe be a bit more pragmatic about it and maybe reduce it to 16 overs, something like that. But otherwise, there are rules there, and we don't go into Duckworth Lewis, but if a game is curtailed early, then it's based on the score after the first six overs.
I suppose, essentially, if it's for fun, then the application of common sense is going to be absolutely everything. Gentlemen, I'm going to stop you there. Hello, good evening. Welcome back to the second hour of On the Front Foot at Suzy 103.4 with me, David Jay, with Tim Bowling, Chris Jacobs waiting in the wings. And at the moment, Matt Camp is with us, the competition manager of the Surrey Slam. Matt, I obviously take stock of Reigate Priory Llamas because that's what they call themselves at all levels of the game. They've even got their own llama song, although it's got nothing to do with llamas or alpacas or anything else South American. It's the Proclaimers, and they came from Scotland last time I noticed. But what about teams naming themselves, Matt?
Well, it was something we started 3 or 4 years ago. It was just to kind of mimic what's going on with the international, well, the IPL game and things like that, I suppose. And it's taken on a life of its own, really. The trouble is I produce the logos for it as well, and it seems like there's been a deliberate attempt to test me this year. But there's some fantastic names out there. I mean, not in this region, but Emmanuel Rumdog Millionaires is my personal favourite.
That found its way into the article that I've got in front of me in the local press. Well, I crossed swords with Emmanuel many times in days long gone by, not so much recently. They have their difficulties with their site, just they're stuck between the railway lines at Clapham Junction, but of course Old Emmanuel are at Blagdon's on the Kingston Bypass, and that's a bit of a horse of a different colour. So I don't know whether you can recall, I've got one or two on the list here in front. Well, Merston Magic, they call themselves the Magics, don't they, Tim? On social media and in general. Hawley Hackers, well, that's about right, although Roy Rogers will never forgive me for saying that. Oxted and Limpsfield Grasshoppers, that makes sense. And the Outward Outlaws. Well, knowing some of their... Onward and Upward. Presumably, Matt, even though it's highly desirable, not many village sides own a set of coloured clothing.
No, that is true. But it's by no means is it mandatory to play in coloured clothing. Again, like I mentioned before, the idea is not to impose a lot of expense on teams. Having said that, we've done a partnership with a clothing company. Darren actually was on earlier, put me in touch with them, and so there is the opportunity there. It's much more affordable than, I've got to admit, I thought it could be. So yes, there is the opportunity there, and we will, in part of the competition is those that qualify for finals day will be loaned a kit, full kit for the day, so that everyone will be in nice colour clothing to make it a good spectacle.
Well, let me ask you to bite the bullet, what's the going rate for a discounted sponsored set of 12 coloured kits?
Well, the full kit being cap, shirt and trousers, so not going into slips and everything, all that sort of stuff. But you can get them for £25 for the set. Which is much, like I said, much better than I was expecting, especially when you look at, you know, so many clubs now are doing their own club shops, which is absolutely great way of doing it. But if you pieced that together through there, you'd be spending pushing 50.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'd have thought that we've got contacts in Sussex, Tim, at Burgess Hill. I mean, I'd have thought by the time you'd got the embroidered trousers and the cap and the sweater and the shirt and a couple of coloured training tops, you're more like 125.
Well, maybe. Yeah. And not to sound too commercial with it, but the guys we've got doing our kit, it's all... All the badge and the numbers and everything is all printed on the shirt, if you like. So that all that added embroidery element is not included. That saves some of the cost, to be honest.
So is it just the top team in each of four regions that goes through to a semi-final at the end?
No, it'd be the top two, and therefore we'll have quarter-finals, and then obviously semis and final. But also, the third and fourth in each group will go into this plate competition, mirroring the main competition, if you like. So all teams will get at least five games, which I'm really happy with. And then 50% of the teams will get at least six games.
And is that going to work over 2 days or more?
So it'll be the same principle. So we'll have the draw, and then the teams will again be responsible for organising their fixture within a fortnight window. So that'll happen for the quarterfinals. Right. So the only dates that are actually set in stone are the regional finals, because that's down to the grounds we're using to host them, and the finals day itself.
And where are those games going to take place?
So we are still in discussions with a few, but we are hoping... do you know what? It's not fair for me to say it.
No, I won't.
But the idea is, for the finals day, is it will be a ground that has two pitches. So therefore, we're not playing three games back to back, where to keep people's attention is a bit tough. So it'll be two semi-finals concurrently, and then come together immediately for the final.
Right, you are, and you'd be looking for one of the bigger clubs, bigger grounds, facilities, if you possibly can. But I don't want to draw you on that, because it's completely unfair to do so. Now, while we're on the immediate topic of the Surrey Slam, Tim, is there anything else that I haven't asked?
Well, I was just wondering that obviously this tournament is the Surrey Slam. I mean, is there any chance or possibility of for example, the winners of the Surrey Slam moving on to a bigger tournament? I don't know if you've had any communication with any other counties that are running similar tournaments.
Well, I've been very fortunate this year to be working with not only guys from Surrey, but guys from the ECB, because it's captured their imagination as well. My understanding is there isn't quite something like this in counties nearby. And so they're very much looking at how this progresses, whether it's a success, and particularly how much traction we get in terms of bringing people back into the game, and the marketing we're doing with that is very key. And so look, it's not going to happen next year, because there isn't a equivalent competition in Kent, say, but I'm hopefully not ruling it out.
Well, it sounds like something that potentially could be quite a massive thing, and with all the work you've done in for Surrey Slam and increased it up to 64 teams, it would, if I was the ECB, I would have someone like you organising it almost on a national level, because it seems to me we could have this type of tournament throughout the country, bringing people back into the game, midweek game, having county finals, even having a national final. We have the Village Cup and so on and so forth that's been running for years, that they play the final at Lords. But this is something which, to me, has got a huge potential.
Well, look, I mean, yes, OK, Surrey is a big county in terms of cricketing participation, but nevertheless the uptake has certainly taken me by surprise. So yeah, I totally agree with you. I don't see why this can't work in other counties, and if you have that pragmatic point of view and that outlook on it, and you're always trying to find the solution, it's easily done. We can always get enough teams to bring it down to a level whereby the travelling's not too far. It makes it more accessible for everybody. I don't see why we can't spread this further.
One other question I just wanted to quickly ask, David, was in terms of, I know you mentioned the idea was to have people playing who might not necessarily been regular players, but at all sort of levels. What's the sort of percentage of Colts that play or have played within the Surrey Slam?
Well, look, one of the things we do is, so whilst there are those eligibility rules that I mentioned before, anyone under 18 at the start of the competition, 7th of May, is exempt from all those eligibility rules. So the idea is, if you've got guys who may well have played here and there for the first team at a big club, chances are they aren't, you know, the stars, if you like. So the idea is, we know this format appeals, don't get me wrong, it appeals to everybody, but it certainly appeals to the younger age cricketer. So there is absolutely no way we're going to propose anything that excludes them. So what we're finding, of course, the Surrey Slam hasn't actually started yet, despite the amount of work that has been put in. A ball hasn't been bowled, but in the South West competition that preceded it, what we're finding is a lot of these clubs are using it as a stepping stone for their youngsters. Of course, they really want to play in it as well.
Just backtracking for a second, there is certainly in the Sussex Cricket League, the Premiership downwards, a T20 competition in our other county of Sussex, and that goes right through the season, and they normally have their finals day, August Bank Holiday Monday at Preston Nomads, which is exactly as Matt has said, is a ground with two pucker pitches. So there's all sorts of potential here. There was one thing I didn't ask. We sort of talked about light and floodlights and weather and all of those things. Historically, of course, there's always been 20 over cricket. I mean, when I was young, we talked about a 20 over thrash, and when I was very young and first at work. I mean, we played a staff 20 over game every Wednesday night against Outwood or Hawley or whoever it was. I just wonder, thinking back to the old Decker Cup, which was 15 8 ball overs, whether you've got it in mind, Matt, to indulge in anything to try and steal 10, 15 minutes back out of the fading light by way of overs or whatever.
Well, the South West competition has always been 15 8 ball overs, as it happens. But unfortunately, where that kind of doesn't work, a lot of people seem to have an issue with it, even though you end up bowling the same number of balls and all that sort of stuff. But one big thing is cricket, in terms of putting it on websites now, is all via Play Cricket, and Play Cricket doesn't have the ability to deal with an 8-ball over, unfortunately. So, but what we've done this year is, so we're doing going back to 26 ball overs, but it will be 10 overs from one end and then 10 overs from the other end. So only the batsman will turn for all but one over, which cuts out an awful lot of time. I mean, hence the reason for 15 8-ball overs in the first place was to cut around five times turning around. So now we're going to cut out 19 of them.
Isn't it amazing how something will always crop up to Fox technology? That had never crossed my mind until you said that then, that these proprietary scoring systems can't handle 8-ball overs. Well, perhaps there's a little niche market there, Tim, for on the front foot. Yes, perhaps we'll get our technology hats on in our spare time. I haven't looked at the new stuff that's come via the Umpires Association, but it is available. Anything else, Matt, that you'd like to say to us about the Slam? Because we're quite tight for time now.
The big thing is that we're working very hard to help players get in touch with clubs. So you can go through the website, which is www.surreyslam.co.uk or .com, and through there you can find your most local side and you can contact them directly. That's the key thing. So they will get your message. It doesn't have to be, a couple of lines. It's your name and your email address, and say that you're interested, just to have a bit of a go. And the good thing is they're all geared up to get back to you. So you will be able to find, because of this fantastic spread of 64 teams, you'll be able to find a club that's near to you. And they're all absolutely open to having guys who come as a midweek member, as it were. So you're not going to get signed up for all the costs that associate yourself with being a member of a club that is based on being a weekend member, as it were. They're geared up for midweek members.
Tell us what your central organisational website is, please.
So www.surreyslam.com.
Well, I'm sure we wish you absolutely every success with it. We've got a couple of minutes, and as we're going to be talking about the wider game nationally and internationally in the last half hour of the show when Chris comes to the microphone, let's just put you on the spot, because we're feeling very proud of ourselves, us two, having been to an ECB ACO evening a fortnight ago tonight. How are you feeling, Matt, about the four levels of sanctions in the new laws and the concept of penalty time?
Well, the great thing about cricket, and you compare to other sports, is that level of that fair play and that attitude and how players should behave themselves. So look, I think we've seen in other sports where you have a degree of if you let these things slide, they get out of control very quickly. I mean, we see some very unsavoury sights on the football pitch, and I think you can't think that you won't get there quickly if you're not careful. So I've got no problem in terms of cracking down on some of these things at all.
So that's fine. That's levels of sanction and penalty runs. I suspect that the concept of penalty time, which is something completely different, is going to be totally alien to many. Let's not go into that now. But, Matt, clearly what we must do, we're not certain what we'll be doing post-season next autumn and winter, but we'd love to have you back to tell us how it's all gone. Matt Camp, competition manager of the Surrey Slam, it's been a complete and utter pleasure to have you with us here tonight at On the Front Foot.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, Chris. Okay, Tim. As we were saying, lots and lots and lots has gone on since we were here last, and I think England probably has to take second place in the winter review to what went on in general in the South Africa-Australia series, and then fairly briefly, because most of what's needed to be said has been said, perhaps just tackle the scandal. What do you think, gents?
Well, you go first, Chris. What are your thoughts on what's been going on?
Personally, I think the punishment in overall is quite harsh. I feel like due to the comments of the Australian Prime Minister and the way that came across, and he used Twitter, I think he used certain types of social media, and came out and said, voiced his opinions. That then got the likes of the public on side with him. That all then transpired into what it transpired. You saw David Warner, Steve Smith, all good. I'm so sorry for what I've done. But still, it's just a harsh punishment. You see, Faf du Plessis has done this twice now. I think it was 2006, and I think it was last year, obviously, Mintgate, they all call it. He, what, got 2 demerit points and a match fine? He lost his match paycheck, I think that's what it's called. I'm just baffled. I'm really confused how Australia are trying to put such a big point across because of the outside pressure rather than the pressure from inside the game, because you've got the ACA that are trying to fight it. I saw the other day the ACA are trying to fight it, and even you've got the likes of, you've got 3 big characters there. You've got Warner, you've got Smith, obviously 2 big catalysts, and they bring the fire for Australia. Bancroft's only recently come in. But they bring the fire in terms of, they bring chat, they bring intensity. But then you've got now Tim Payne taking over, who's not that same type of character. He's quite laid back, he's quite a chilled leadership. And Dean Elgar said today, it just didn't feel like a test match. It just was the most placid game he has ever played in as a test match. I mean, because there was no fight there at all.
That's the problem. The whole of the fight had been sucked out of that particular series now, hasn't it? But I think that the thing, you're quite right, you mentioned the fact that other players have been involved with similar antics and haven't had such strict penalties. My personal view would be that was wrong. They should have been punished more. Personally, if it was me, I would ban Smith, Bancroft, well, certainly Smith and Warner for 5 years. And I've been banned for 5 years. Bancroft is the only one I have an element of sympathy for, because he's in a team with some pretty strong characters. He's a young guy, David Warner.
But he's not a young guy, is it?
Well, he's relatively new to that.
He's young
team,
for the test side, but he's 25 years old. He's his own man.
But the point is, he's been asked to do something which he's felt that perhaps he didn't have a lot of choice. If David Warner comes up to you and you're a youngish player in the team and says, I want you to take this piece of sandpaper and I want you to rough the ball up, you can't. You've got nowhere to go to report him. You've just got to get on with it. So I'm not condoning what he's done. I have an element of sympathy for Bancroft, only an element. However, I would still have banned Smith for 5 years, Warner for 5 years. They've all gone on TV. Typical virtue signalling, crying their eyes out because they've been caught. They're not, for me personally, I don't think that they're at all apologetic for what they've done. They just don't like the fact they've been caught, and they know that the Australian public have hung them out to dry. And I think in all the previous instances where this has happened, all of those players should equally have been punished. But don't forget, this is, to a certain degree, is a far more premeditated activity. That they've discussed it, they've even gone and got the sandpaper and put together an actual game plan as to how to rough this ball up. They talk about it being an isolated incident. Well, okay, did it happen in the England, in the Ashes? Who knows?
Michael Atherton, who speaks with the voice of experience, let it be said, made the point that ball tampering has gone on since the year dot. Altering the condition of the ball has been more or less allowable in successive revisions of the laws. I mean, I go back to when J.K. Lever of Essex was bowling with Vaseline strips on his eyebrows in India, and he was reported, and all sorts of means of altering the condition of the ball. And without doubt, you know, When dear old Darrell Hare took it on himself to make an exhibition of the Pakistanis, and there was nearly an international incident, I suppose that was an instance of what Matt was talking about earlier, you know, and what Darren was talking about earlier, this business of enforcing the letter of the law rather than stepping in before it becomes an incident. But to me, I think that ball tampering is what it is. It's a level 2 offence for a reason rather than a level 4 offence. And let's be clear that we're not talking about sanctions in terms of the new laws of cricket here. We're talking about ICC test match playing conditions. To me, it was the fact that to try and cover things up, the Australians moved the goalposts every time afterwards that somebody else went and spoke to the media. And clearly there was a great deal of turmoil. And I I suspect that Cricket Australia have not forgiven the ACA for the pay dispute, and that that had a great deal to do with it as well. To me, I'm an old man now, but to me, yes, it was caught with your hands in the biscuit tin, and yes, those were crocodile tears.
I mean, you're right, they have moved the goalpost, because originally they said, oh, well, it was sticky tape, and it was grit that was sticking to the tape. And then it turned out to be sandpaper. Steve Smith, during his press conference, talked about the leadership group who we alluded to earlier. He said, oh, I'm not naming names. He should be forced to name names about who the leadership group are, because it's clearly not just him and Warner. There must be other people in that leadership group who have escaped punishment.
I very much doubt the coach didn't know anything about it. Well, Layman knew something about it.
He said today that when he was on the walkie-talkie, well, I don't think he said it today, but he said recently, when he was on the walkie-talkie that looked like he was giving a message to the 12th man to go and tell Bancroft to hide the sandpaper, now, actually what he was saying to the 12th man was, what on earth is going on? Or words to that effect.
Yeah.
What is going on here? Yeah, and so, okay, maybe he did say that. He claims he didn't know about it. He should know about it. He's the coach of the Australian cricket team. If he doesn't know what's going on in the Australian cricket dressing room, especially when there's clearly been collusion here, then he's not doing his job properly.
Yeah, then you bring on the point that Steve Smith, he wasn't involved in coming up with the plan. He wasn't involved. The only reason why he was involved in this is because he stopped himself from reporting it. Because what came out is Warner was the one that instigated it, Bancroft carried it out, Smith just didn't report it. That is the why he's been caught up. But because he's the captain and didn't report it, that is why he's been caught up in this.
It's not just not reporting it, it's covering it up, isn't it? He tried to cover up when they were on the field of play and the umpires went over to Bancroft and Bancroft produced the sunglasses case from his pocket and said, oh no, this is all I've got in my pocket, because he'd already hidden the sandpaper down his trousers. Smith was there. Smith knew exactly what was going on. So, yeah, you're right. He didn't report it. He should have stood up to Warner. Again, that's the job of a proper test captain. He didn't stand up to Warner, and then he proceeded to cover the whole thing up. So, yeah, you're right. He didn't instigate it, but he didn't just not report it. He covered it up as well.
Ultimately, I think in law, whether it's ICC playing regulations or whether it's the laws of cricket, the captain is responsible for what goes on the other side of the white line, full stop.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, looking at it from the perspective of my age and the whole crocodile tears thing, I think that, you know, it has to be germane that the previous time Smith and Bancroft were together at a press conference, they were taking the mickey out of Johnny Bairstow's headbutt. I don't know whether you saw Ali Mitchell, who apparently bumped into them in the corridor afterwards. She said on a public platform that they were giggling like schoolboys, and they saw her coming the other way and instantly pulled down the shutters. But more than that, I think I've used the term crocodile tears. It's been a term used all over social media. And to me, for Warner to sit there hanging his head penitently and crying about being found out doesn't sit terribly well to me with the way he made such public capital out of Jonathan Trott's very obvious and very real mental distress on that tour, which just crumbled and fell apart. Can I just say one other thing as well? I mean, it's not just this isolated incident. Clearly, this is a particularly ill-tempered series between two teams that haven't got very much time for one another. I thought AB de Villiers rose spectacularly above it with the quality of his batting. But you see, Rabada's got previous. And, okay, we don't want to put a young man off his game because he's only 23 years old or whatever and potentially an express fast bowler and so on and so forth. But he's got previous. He's got the business with Stokes last time. And of all the people not to barge, although who barged whom is open to question, but why, oh why, would you take on Steve Smith at a stage in your career that Rabada has reached? And then, of course, he was sanctioned. And as Chris has said about Faf du Plessis, promptly led off. It's a difficult one, but certainly it was an ill-tempered and unpleasant series from the word go.
That, I think, was part of the problem, though. That my understanding was that the Australians had set out to try and get Rabada certain amount of demerit so he couldn't play.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that when you watch some of the pundits, I think David Lloyd and Robert Key were two who I watched, and their reaction to the whole thing, I think, summed it up perfectly in the fact that they both said the Australian team, this particular Australian team, is out of control, and that they do their level best to... They complained about the South African crowd being too hostile, which is hilarious, given anybody that's ever played or watched a game in Australia. The Australian crowd is probably the most hostile crowd.
Considering what crowd actually turned up.
Well, yes, yeah, quite. But they complained about the crowds. They tried to get Rabada banned. They, as David said, the incident with Jonathan Trott was just outrageous. You know, the incident with Johnny Bairstow. All this stuff just went on and on and on, to the point at which, when they finally got caught doing what they did, everybody in the media just said, well, as we had the song we played earlier, it's karma.
This is what's being brought up, though, isn't it? It's being brought up through the media, and it's the only way they're going to get caught, because I very much doubt that this is... This will be happening in village cricket, grade cricket, all through Australia, is the type of characters they are. I've talked to people that have been over there, and then take out the ball tampering, all that type of thing, but this type of chat that they come up with, and the creativity of the types of way to goad people, this is a regular thing.
Well, that's
from top to bottom.
Yeah, I mean, and I guess that's part of the reason that the new sanctions have come in, to try and somehow keep a lid on that. Personally, I don't mind playing in a game where there's an element of chat going on, as long as it's not personal and it's about the actual match. I don't have an issue with that, and I don't have an issue with that at Test cricket. I think I do have an issue when certain teams, as Australia have been found out to be, start really pushing those boundaries and start ball tampering, start alluding to mental health issues for players and things like that, which is just unacceptable. And you cannot have a situation where these players are allowed to get off. I know you've said that you think a year is harsh. I honestly think it's just far too lenient. I think a year will not put people off enough to stop doing this.
I have to say that when Lewis Hatchett from East Grinstead was sitting in the chair that Chris is sitting in at the moment, he and his brother clearly came back full of respect and admiration for Australian grade cricket, and a lot of their success at East Grinstead, I think, has been modelled on the model of the club that they played for in senior grade cricket out there, and I don't notice that involving too much in the way of dodgy conduct.
No.
The other thing that really struck me, pots and kettles, was Steve Waugh, of all people, Mr. Mental Disintegration, saying this has got to be stamped out of Australian cricket, we don't need it.
Well, it's funny, isn't it, how many of the players have fallen on one side or the other. I think Michael Vaughan was very critical of the length of ban, but then you look on the other side, the likes of Shane Warne said it should have been more lenient. Derek Pringle said it should be more lenient. Derek Pringle, I mean, I have an article in front of me, Derek Pringle wrote that he actually believes that the laws should be changed so that you can actually let's call it tamper with the ball, not with bottle tops and things like that, but within the bounds of the actual field of play.
It's a very thin line at the moment, because you've got the likes of use of foreign objects which have been used, then you've got a line, and then there's people that throw and scuff up the ball.
Yes, exactly.
It's everyone talks about every single test series, every single match that comes on. People don't throw in on the full anymore. Everyone goes in on one, two bounces, three bounces even sometimes, just to scuff up the ball to get an advantage.
And I think that remains a grey area, even in these new laws. I mean, for heaven's sake, the sort of cricket that we've all played in, people have to bounce it into the keeper because they can't reach. It's levels again, isn't it, and so on. Well, you mentioned Rob Key, Tim. Rob Key said very early on in the piece, I've had enough of Australia.
Yes, he did. Yeah.
And I think we have too, so let's talk about England and New Zealand.
Chris, what do you think? How do you think we've done?
I think it's appalling that the first chance you get to bat at their first day, lovely pitch to bat on, not much green, not doing much, drop in pitch, straight boundaries 50 metres, you're bowled out for 58.
Yeah.
Is appalling. I mean, what's typified our winter is Moeen Ali's dismissal in that innings. A full toss, about shin height, straight in. I mean, play it straight. I mean, even your usual village cricketer at the weekend, I know, Trent Bolt might be bowling, 80 mile an hour, 85 mile an hour, swinging it a little bit. But this is an international cricketer who's batting, at seven, but he's still a decent enough batsman to not play all round a straight one, a full toss, which should just be batted back to the bowler. I think that typifies England's winter.
Yeah, I mean, you're quite right, Chris. I mean, the whole thing was embarrassing. I mean, I woke up to hear the score as it was and couldn't believe that how few runs we'd scored. And I think we were very close. I think at one point were we not 27-9 or something?
Yeah, it was Craig Overton that dug us out a bit. Yeah. We just biffed a few.
And I think the irony was that the lowest previous score was on that ground, I believe.
26.
Yeah, New Zealand against England. So how ironic it would have been had we collapsed that figure, which was pretty likely at the time, but to get bowled out for 58, and then obviously we went all the way through to the final day of the last test and we needed to try and take 10 wickets. Okay, we took 8.
I feel that's the bigger problem. The bowling unit is the bigger problem, the batting unit.
Well, you're quite right. We're still reliant on James Anderson and Stuart Broad even now. We're reluctant to throw spinners in, and also during some of those periods of play, I love Joe Root as a batsman. I think he's one of the greatest, well, potentially could be one of the greatest batsmen we've ever produced. But as a captain, he just there seems to be no sort of creative thinking about how to get these players out. You know, throw the ball to somebody unusual, do something different. And he just didn't do that. And it worries me because it's the same as we had with Alistair Cook.
Because with the likes of, I think your perfect captain, as in what I'm looking at, in the last few years I've seen is when the last time New Zealand came over, yes, they might have been nipped out quite cheap in a couple of innings, but the way Brendan McCullum came out at Lord's in that first test match of two test matches, the amount of creative ways he came up with to try and get English batsmen out was ridiculous. He would have like three men at leg slip just for a flick round the corner. Mm. And the way he would come out attacking, not just himself, but bring it in his side. And Joe Root, he's just not got that kind of, I wouldn't say mental state, I'd say
I don't think he has the vision on the pitch.
Yeah, exactly. But I think this captaincy is affecting him now, because he did have a little problem with conversion, but now it's like, what, he can't convert a 50 to 100 for love nor money?
Well, the problem is we've fallen into that trap now of picking captains based on who the best player is. And that's a dangerous route to go down. And let's be honest, way, way back before your time, Chris, Ian Botham was made captain very early on in his career because he was the best player in the team at the time. Totally unsuitable to be captain.
You've got the likes of Flintoff.
Yeah, Flintoff exactly.
And then, this is before my time, but probably best England captain, you guys might agree, might disagree, Mike Brearley. He was a county player, but he was a good, great captain.
Yeah, well, that's the point. I mean, You look at that England team and you think, well, who could be a captain within it? That's part of the problem. Personally, I would have Johnny Bairstow as captain, just because he brings something different. When he's interviewed, he talks about things in a different way than the likes of Root and Cook and those sort of players do. Just try something different. We have got to try and start doing things different at English Test cricket.
Yeah, they're not going to do that, though, are they? No. Can I just make a couple of points? One, as far as Root is concerned, the media are on his case with this business of conversion rates. In a very, very difficult winter, where the captain is the number one target for the opposition bowling attack, I think I'd settle for 520 at 40 odd in those circumstances. The second thing is that we have all played in matches where a club side has been bowled out for 46 or whatever. Sometimes it's been the sort of pitch, admittedly, where the other lot were 47-9 and won by one wicket. But it does happen, even at the very highest level. And I do think sometimes we're so used to all this talk about T20 earlier on and the ball sailing out of the ground on perfect pitches and all the rest of it. We always talk about batsmen failing. Are we going to give Bolton Southee a bit of credit for bowling England out for 58?
Well, yes.
Yeah, I think you've got to, don't you? The way they've been incredible. I think they've, got three quarters to seven-eighths of their wickets? Mm. I think the two innings that they bowled against us in the last test match, they picked up every wicket.
Yeah.
Which is just credit to their talent and the way they can control the ball.
But it's very much the same with Broad and Anderson, as you said earlier on. And OK, Stuart Broad appeared at last to have rediscovered his mojo, or whatever they call it. But, I mean, I see no reason why James Anderson couldn't be a Richard Hadley, why he couldn't still be bowling fast medium at the age of 40. And the way things are, you know, we were talking, weren't we, the first summer that we did this show about, how England have got plenty of cabs on the rank, and, you know, the fast bowling cupboard is far from bare, but the trouble is they're all identical black cabs.
Yeah.
And, you know, there doesn't really look to be anybody. I mean, Mark Wood is going to be Simon Jones again, isn't he? He's going to be Frank Tyson in the 50s. He's going to be somebody whose meteor rises, flares, and dies on this recent showing. What do you make of the left armour from Somerset?
I think he's useful. I think he's someone that you can rely on for the next few years and build around while you get the likes of a, obviously, Mason Crane played in Australia. Not saying he's the go-to guy or the heir apparent. You're not going to get another Shane Warne. That's just fact. You're not going to get someone like that. But if you can then use Jack Leach for, like, kind of the stopgap that Moeen Ali was supposed to be, but Jack Leach is a bit better than that, because on these pitches that will benefit a spinner, he will use that to his advantage, and he can turn the ball, but he won't rip it past the batsman's edge.
I did feel sorry for Mason Crane, though, having waited so long, let's say, for his opportunity to play, and then I think he has a stress fracture of the spine.
I think it was something like that.
Yeah, it's enough to keep him out for several months. I did feel sorry for him when he, you know, finally been thrown in. It was being thrown in at the deep end to a certain degree, but, you know, that's maybe the best way of actually bringing these players through. But, you know, since Graham Swan retired, we just haven't replaced him.
No,
and there isn't. I mean, okay, maybe there is somebody floating around in county cricket. I don't know, but they're not somebody that's jumping up and down enough to say yes, he definitely should be in the side.
May I, at the risk of repeating myself, just ask the question again? You're talking now about Mason Crane. Why is it that for the last 20 years we've had fitness coaches and fielding coaches and nutritionists and even a chaplain at one point, and half of them are always blooming well injured?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's because these injuries are picked up more, and in the old days people played through injuries more because they weren't able to be diagnosed as well as they are today. I don't know, but it does seem that there are an awful lot more of these injuries that keep players out for an awful lot more time.
Strange, because there's more of these sports scientists come up, there's more injuries, so shouldn't that be coming down the other way?
Absolutely, yeah. That's my point. What do you think about the fact that, by any stretch of the imagination, this tour ended in the Antipodean equivalent of our October, the second month of autumn, and really and truly was, you know, the middle of May right through till the end of October in an English summer, and all the coming and going and very, very long-haul flights for individuals there and back again that involved. Was it too much to bite off in the first place?
Yeah, I think a lot of those players had more or less had enough, and I was listening to the last session of the final test, and you could hear them on Test Match Special talking about how cold it was, and I think a lot of those players, you could see their demeanour afterwards when the game was over and they were doing all the various press interviews and presentations. Most of those England players were standing around with their hands in their pockets, looking fed up, not wanting to be there, and I think it's been such a long tour now for them, and that's no excuse for them not to perform. They're professional players and they're paid to do that, but I think in many ways, coming off the back of a 4-0 Ashes loss, a lot of those players perhaps thought they'd have quite an easy ride in New Zealand, score runs, take wickets, and it wasn't quite as straightforward as
they
thought.
It used to be.
Yeah.
It used to be, but now they're no pushovers anymore.
And unfortunately, because of that, they've just... you could see in a lot of those players, especially the players that had been in Australia as well, they had had enough of it, basically.
We've flown a kite for Broad and Anderson and said that there is no alternative. What's the advice from on the front foot to Alastair Cook?
I don't know. Chris, what do you think?
I think he has very much suffered from the last couple of tours, obviously, New Zealand and Australia, apart from that 244 on a road.
Yeah.
That wasn't worthy of even a village pitch. But he's that type of character that everybody puts him down, then he'll come back and score 150 and save you or win you a test match. So I still believe he still has a place in this England side. I think you need to keep him there because of the uncertainty of his opening partner for the present time.
Yeah, well, that's true.
Because Stoneman, it looks like he will be coming back. His problem is kicking on. He's getting 50s. He's not kicking on like many other English batsmen.
And he's dropping catches.
Dropping catches as well. But there is a massive, massive media hype in the last few days of getting Haseeb Hameed back in there.
Yeah, I've got to say, I'm not a big fan of his. I think he's a good county player. He did score a century, didn't he, when he last played for England?
82 with a broken finger.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure he's the answer. I don't know who is, but I'm not sure he is. I know he is being mentioned as a potential, and without any other sort of decent alternatives, perhaps he'll be pushed in.
All I'd say about that is that when Duncan Fletcher went out looking after Nasser Hussain took over, getting on for 20 years ago, there may not have been statistics to back it up, but he liked what he saw in Marcus Trescothick and picked him out of the blue, and we all know what came of that.
Yep. Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, personally, I think you look at the likes of Jason Roy, those type of guys, Joss Butler, I'm surprised they're not used more in Test cricket. I know they're pigeonholed as one-day players and short-form players, and a lot of these players now are only taking white ball contracts, and we can talk about that in another show. But they do well enough at 50-over cricket, and we perform badly enough at Test cricket for me to give them a run and see how they do.
Yeah, I'd back Jason Roy, definitely. Butler, I'd still give him a go, but where would you fit him in the side now? Would you put him as a keeper, batsman? But the one with Roy is the problem with him is in four-day cricket, I don't think he's ever opened for Surrey. He bats a six, so there's no swing on the ball.
I mean,
can just hit through the line.
There are other net, like Rory Burns, for example, could be used in the England setup.
How old's he?
Well,
he's 30, or he's ticking on a bit.
But again, his time—he should have been given opportunities. And I, you know, for want of a better alternative, at the moment we're sticking with this same thing. You know, Stoneman, Vince, all these sort of players who aren't performing.
I think Rory Burns has had a bit of a short straw. I mean, I'd bite the bullet to mix my metaphors with Joss Butler and give him Bairstow's job and say to Johnny Bairstow, look, I'm sorry, I know you love keeping, but you're also the best batter in the side at the moment.
Oh, he needs
take
to
that on, you know, and bat up the order. Chris, Tim said we'd save it for another show, but you weren't here last time. What's your take on the Rashid Hales and possibly others pulling out of Red Ball cricket at the same time as Owen Morgan, before he broke his hand or whatever he's done, said he wanted to play some Red Ball cricket now? What that was all about, I don't know. What's your take at the same time as you've got Morgan, and more by implication than word for word Butler, taking the view that first class cricket and Test cricket is going to die and there will only be T20?
It's the governing body's fault. It's 100% the governing body's fault, because you're given these guys chances, they have performed, but the point is with the ECB, with the selection committee, every single time they will keep selecting players, but they may perform, they may not perform, but they're not given enough time to bed in a bit. Alex Hales was, yes, he might have batted at the top of the order, he might have struggled a little bit, but he was that type of player that was a David Warner type class batsman that could
he can take the game away from the opposition straight away, can't he?
The problem is Hamid may be a fix, but the point is he's too much like Cook.
Yes.
And can you imagine 25 without loss off 25 overs at the start of a test match on first morning?
That's better than 58 all out and the same number of overs, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think, you know, in overall terms to me, then you're absolutely right, and that if you do give Hamid a run, then it's Hamid for Cook. And I would be quite happy to say to Jason Roy, it doesn't matter if you get out early, go out there in a test match and do what you do every so often in a 50-over game, and if he gets 100 before lunch, we're up and running. I think, for all the novelty in cricket, it seems to me that an awful lot of it is still very formulaic.
Yeah, definitely. And I think we have fallen into this trap of pigeonholing players in this country that they can only play in one form of cricket, to the point at which many of those players believe that they can only play in one form of cricket. The likes of Alex Hales, it's clear when he was given chances in the Test match arena, it was a mental thing. He just couldn't cope with the fact that he didn't really know how to play, because he usually was allowed to go out and just play a natural game. In the Test match arena, all of a sudden he's told, no, you can't play like that anymore. Let him play like that. Put him
exactly
in the Test team. Let him play his natural game, see how he goes.
But it's not from just there. It's like the likes of the under-19s in the World Cup. They, bat against bowling machine, got knocked out pretty early. The Indian lads, play as freely as you like, play whichever way you want to, your natural flair game. They got to the final Wonder Tournament, didn't they?
Yeah. And India wants to play more, not less, test cricket. Mm. 30 seconds each, gentlemen. Are you looking forward to the IPL or not?
No.
Well, that's a lot less than 30 seconds. Do you want to put a little bit of icing on the cake?
I think the IPL has to be brutally honest, has probably been done to death now. I think it's very difficult, I think, for anybody other than an Indian spectators to get excited about the teams. I think we see it so much now, the amount of money that's sloshing around. I've got really no interest in the IPL at all. I think it's a tournament which is being done just for the money now.
Chris, any final thoughts?
I feel it's now very much overrated as a spectacle. I think the Big Bash has taken over as in the perfect, not the perfect way, but the best way to tackle that. But I think it's just because of the craze of the Indian fans, the Pakistani fans, all the people that are out there. That is the craze for it.
I'm going to have to stop you there. Thank you ever so much for your patience hanging around in the wings tonight and then joining in with the final bit of the show. There's far more that we could talk about, but no doubt we'll have the chance to do that at a future stage. Tim, I know you moved mountains to get back here tonight.
Yes, it was a struggle to get here. It's been good fun, though.
So thank you very much for that as well. That's Chris Jacobs and Tim Bowling. And finally, my thanks to our guests. That's Darren Talbot, the man of many hats and many strings to his violin. I keep saying that, but what a lovely chap as well. And we wish Matt Camp and the Surrey Slam every possible success now that it's up to 64 teams. It's an absolutely wonderful undertaking. You've been listening to On the Front Foot, Suzy Radio's cricket chat show.